This is PCJ Radio on 88.2 FM. This is PCJ Radio on 107.5 FM in Nairobi, Kenya. And nationwide on 5. This is PCJ Radio on KBCT in Waco, Texas. This is PCJ Radio on 9955 kilohertz to Latin America. This is PCJ Radio on 7590 kilohertz DRM. On shortwave, satellite, and the internet, this is PCJ Radio.
Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio. Coming up today, ASEAN powerless over China's territorial claims in the South China Sea, Australian military plans to withdraw from Solomon Islands, and as China's economy grows, so does its waistline. We have this and more on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. ASEAN seems powerless as it grapples with the problem of China's territorial claims to the South China Sea, home to vital shipping lanes and rich mineral and fish resources. Philippine President Benigno Aquino this week called on his nation to show strong resolve against China's strident rhetoric. In a nationwide address, the president said his government has shown forbearance and goodwill in the long-running dispute with China over the Scarborough Shoal. Walden Bellow of the Acabanya Party, part of Aquino's administration coalition, says the Philippine people are united behind the president against Beijing, but would prefer to settle the issue without conflict. Up next, Sen Lam speaks to economist and activist-turned-congressman Dr. Walden Bellow.
This has been perceived by the people as bullying on the part of China. Wherever you look in terms of the internet, it's very much backing the assertion of Philippine sovereignty because there's a perception that China is overreaching. So, yes, I would say that he does have the backing of the people on this one.
China on the weekend announced that it will garrison an island in the Paracels group. Is the Philippines prepared to stare down the Chinese? Will you be prepared to move naval vessels in the area?
Well, you know, I don't think that the response that people want is to respond with force to China's move. The focus of the president has been to stress a diplomatic solution to the issue, to discuss it bilaterally with China, as well as to bring it to multilateral fora like the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. But at the same time, there is a sense that for defensive purposes, the country must be able to have good defense capabilities, you know, without being provocative. I don't think that there's any intention on the part of the government to challenge China militarily. We would not stand a chance. So you have to combine diplomacy as well as a military capability, but with the emphasis being on diplomacy.
The U.S. has stressed neutrality in the past on issues like the Spratlys and the Paracels. It has, however, shifted its focus to Asia in terms of security resources. Will the Philippines be looking to the U.S. for support if push comes to shove?
Well, there are parts of the government, certain representatives of the government, that have favored bringing the United States in as a first line of defense. But I don't think that is the dominant position within the government at this point in time. We do not favor bringing in the United States as the main response to China, because once you bring in the United States, then what is a legitimate dispute over territory becomes a superpower conflict. And the main effect of that is to marginalize the territorial issue. There are those of us within the government that are basically saying that we have to rely first of all on ourselves, secondly on our neighbors, and be very, very careful about the way that the United States steps into the situation.
You speak of relying on your neighbors. Are you frustrated that ASEAN as a grouping has proven to be quite ineffective on this issue, especially given that four of its members have claims on the Spratlys?
Yes, I think that many of us have been disappointed at this, but at the same time, we're not giving up hope. I think we should just keep pressing ASEAN on this, because ultimately, it is our main regional backup, our main regional reference group when it comes to this.
While China shows no signs of backing down, it does seem that the options that are open to the Philippines are fairly limited. What fires your optimism that this issue can be resolved in a pacifist way through diplomacy?
I think we must distinguish between Chinese rhetoric and what it actually will do. I think that especially at this point that there is a leadership transition in China, and everybody with every faction within the Chinese party are trying to seem tough. To some extent, you expect this kind of militant kind of discourse and rhetoric. Once the leadership transition is over, then you might find more flexibility on the part of the Chinese. Secondly, the actual Chinese deployments that accompanies its rhetoric, these are not major warship deployments. Yes, they established that prefecture in the Sancha Islands. Yes, we must protest that diplomatically, but the important thing is we don't allow this thing to degenerate into a superpower confrontation. And the danger of bringing the United States in to the process is that it could develop into that at this point in time, because China's record in terms of aggressive action is really quite minimal compared to that of the United States. We must look at the great dangers of the United States coming into this process, because historically this is a fairly aggressive power when it comes to power projection.
Dr. Walden Bello from the Philippines speaking with Sen Lam. The Australian government is preparing for a dramatic shift in aid and military assistance it provides to Solomon Islands. The Regional Assistance Mission to Solomon Islands, or RAMSI, is due to start downsizing in the middle of next year, and not everyone is convinced this is a good idea. The head of the mission says he is confident the time is right, but convincing the locals is a different matter. We have this report from Stephanie March.
Australian soldiers have been a common feature of the Solomon Islands landscape over the past 9 years, but that will soon change.
The military component of RAMSI, which is currently around 170 personnel, is likely to be withdrawn in the second half of 2013.
Nicholas Koppel is the head of the Regional Assistance Mission to Solomon Islands, which was set up to help the nation recover after the violent ethnic tensions in the late 1990s and early 2000s. Until now, the mission's been made up of three parts: military assistance, strengthening the public service, and policing. 2013 will mark the beginning of what RAMSI's calling its transition phase, a significant downsizing of the mission. Part of it will include Australian police relinquishing their frontline role. Solomon Islands police have performed well during bouts of potential civil unrest, but they're still struggling to provide basic policing services in some provincial areas.
So instead of RAMSI doing the policing side by side with the Solomon Islands, we've stepped back and providing support in the way of logistical support. Often it's a case of fuel, vehicles, outboard motors.
The mission's support to government ministries will be taken over by aid agencies.
RAMSI's a short-term intervention. It's funded on a four-year cycle. So we cannot plan for the long term in the way RAMSI's funded. Donors can, and that delivers better service, if you like, a better plans for the government, for the different ministries. But it also conveys a better image of the country. It's no longer a post-conflict intervention. It is development assistance for a developing country.
But there are challenges ahead. Dr. Matthew Allen is an expert in Pacific history and resource conflict at the Australian National University.
There have been a few hiccups and bumps, but that situation, RAMSI has managed to maintain law and order. And there's been quite spectacular economic growth in Solomon Islands since 2003. So the big question with drawdown and exit is, you know, how are these gains to be sustained into the future?
RAMSI Special Coordinator Nicholas Koppel.
I think in terms of ridding the country of militants, I think that's very sustainable. There's no sign of militancy returning to the Solomon Islands. In the area of development assistance for the government ministries, enormous progress has been made. I mean, we're bringing in balanced budgets, the government debt has been reduced quite dramatically. We're seeing big improvements there. But further assistance will be provided to sustain those gains.
Dr. Matthew Allen says it's the country's future economic prospects that may be its undoing. Logging opportunities are expected to run out by 2015, and economists expect the nation will turn to mining to fill the void.
And we know from neighbouring Papua New Guinea that there's a very close relationship between local level conflict and even provincial level conflict and secessionist conflict, if we think about the Bougainvillean conflict and mining. So this shift to mining is a matter of some concern.
Nicholas Koppel agrees maintaining a strong economy is key to Solomon Islands' overall stability.
If the population can get jobs, can be gainfully employed, they start to have a vested interest in their own economy and in their own society, and things like that can help very much ensure the peace and the prosperity of the Solomon Islands. It's not just a matter of a strong and well-equipped and armed, if you like, police force.
Ramsay was never supposed to stay forever, but it seems to have become a victim of its own success. The majority of Solomon Islanders want the mission to stay, and Ramsay's boss is struggling to convince them it's time for a change.
We're doing a lot of work, but I would say I don't think I've been enormously successful in this regard. The difficulty is because of those three components of Ramsay and because we are doing different things with each element, that it's hard to explain that in simple words, in a simple message to the people of Solomon Islands. I think it's understood at ministerial and senior public service levels. We've worked very hard there. We're trying hard also with communities, but I think it is proving more difficult there.
It's never been so hard being so popular.
That was Stephanie March reporting. The opening up of China has produced many benefits for the people of the world's most populous country, but there are challenges too. Growing prosperity has led to more fatty processed foods entering the Chinese diet. And coupled with less fresh food and children who don't exercise, the result is an obesity epidemic. A new study has uncovered evidence to show that the number of Chinese teenagers with diabetes is nearly four times higher than among their peers in the United States. Stephen McDonald reports.
Let's go!
In the southern Chinese city of Shenzhen, a group of 30 or so overweight teenagers are training like there's no tomorrow.
Let's go.
This is a live-in weight loss camp that requires huge commitment. In the sweltering summer, they jog, lift weights, and do aerobics 5 hours a day, 7 days a week, for months on end. The only food available is that which is provided by the coaches. The objective is clear. Eat good food and train like professional athletes with a view to losing plenty of kilos. When I first came here, I weighed 89 kilograms, says one teenage girl. I only planned to stay for 2 months at first to see whether it worked. Well, now I've registered for another 2 months because I've lost 16 kilograms already. The reason for such desperate measures is that China's diet has changed drastically in recent times. The opening up of the country has meant an enormous influx of junk food chains, especially from the United States, which have only increased in number over the past 5 years. According to experts, more fatty processed foods, less fresh food, and kids who don't exercise is leading to an explosion of obesity in China. A new study by the University of North Carolina has found that Chinese teenagers have diabetes rates nearly four times greater than their counterparts in the United States. Doctors here are also bracing for a wave of heart disease in the coming years. What's more, back at the weight loss camp, participants tell us that their self-esteem has been taking a beating. After putting on 15 kilograms, I looked much bigger than before, says one girl. I felt uncomfortable and I lost confidence. My parents worried about me.
Well,
what did your parents say, we ask her. They told me to lose weight because I was unhealthy and not looking good. The challenge for Chinese policymakers is the same as that in many countries. How do you, on the one hand, respect people's right to eat unhealthy food if they choose to, while on the other, managing a public health crisis as a result of this junk food invasion?
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio. Vanuatu is set to become the world leader in involving the smallest coca growers in taking their product to the world. A new database system will allow growers to take charge of their own organic or fair trade certification for the first time and directly link them with customers. Jemana Garrett has the story.
Much of the world's cocoa is grown on big plantations. Vanuatu's cocoa, like that from many other Pacific countries, is high quality and organic. But because farmers have very small plots, it's been hard for them to compete. African Pacific Vanuatu Limited is a new kind of private sector organisation. It calls itself a transparent service provider, a matchmaker dedicated to getting a better deal for growers. Managing Director Andreas Lombardozzi says the first step was getting cocoa growers together.
From 2007, we've doubled the price in cocoa just by really bringing the competition in and marketing Vanuatu Origin in, within, you know, Hague's in Australia is now supporting Vanuatu Cocoa, which is just absolutely fantastic, and building a relationship with Vanuatu cocoa growers.
The next step is much more radical. It aims to put ownership of organic and fair trade certification in the hands of the grower. Demand for traceable, ethical and organic cocoa is strong, but only 10% of the world's cocoa is certified. For small growers, certification costs are high, but in Vanuatu they're being overcome by using mobile communications to create and update an accurate computer-based database that can be controlled by growers. Andreas Lombardozzi says the new certification process is very different to that of the past.
The certification would be paid for, in terms of organic at least, would be paid for by maybe a processor, and he would include a particular grower group within that certification. But that means the grower had to sell his organic through that particular processor, and that eliminated competition. And even in terms of some fair trade certification, once that grower is certified under that relationship, he doesn't own that. He doesn't have that data at hand. And so it's very difficult for him to say, okay, well, I've got fair trade, but I want to sell to a Rainforest Alliance or another certification group. He can't do that. But in terms of our new system, when they own the certification themselves, because they have presented themselves as the owner of the data, then you can start creating competition between the certification bodies. And I think that's the new way that, you know, we can drive down the costs, you know, reduce the burden of certification away from the grower. And the grower in the past has carried the burden of certification, and that's not necessarily fair. And so in this new system, it's the certification bodies that will have to compete to get the grower's product.
Andreas Lombardozzi, Managing Director of African Pacific Vanuatu Limited. The new certification process and the database are being extended to include an electronic payment system. Farmers will need to learn new skills. Peter Napwat, CEO of the Vanuatu Agriculture College, is ready to help.
We have only one mandate, and that mandate is to train farmers in Vanuatu, and that's who we are. And so if there is anything that's new, we will bring it onto the Vanuatu Agriculture College. Every time I always look around to look for different agriculture innovation that must give farmers the edge to be able to compete on the market. So I'm grateful that Africa Pacific and BGUP actually came in and we started something different. We're just beginning to revolutionise for farming in Vanuatu in a very big way, I can see it.
The database is already helping African Pacific Limited and Agricultural Extension officers respond better to farmers' needs. It revealed more than half of Vanuatu's cocoa farmers are growing less than half a hectare of cocoa, not enough for sustainable living. Andreas Lombardozzi.
We can now look at them in the database, call them up from that database and approach them directly and first find out, do you have more land? And from that point of view, we can really now engage, and then we can send the extension officers out to them. We can create appointments for them. I mean, suddenly what you're doing is you're moving from a very chaotic and dispersed and top-down system to a system that serves the grower in terms of his needs, and you're creating that relationship just like we would in Australia or anywhere else. And I think meeting the grower at his own level and meeting it one-to-one in a very equal relationship is core to this.
African Pacific Vanuatu Limited has already got runs on the board with its Nui line of coconut-based cosmetic products and organic chocolate. Peter Napwat is optimistic that grower-owned databases and mobile technology will have a lot more benefits for farmers.
There are a lot of products out there, and I think that what we've started here may lead on to other products as well. We really don't know where we can stop. At the moment, we're dealing with coconut and cocoa only, but there's coffee there as well, and there's other things. So the scope for Vanuatu engaging with this, the system that we've set up, is really great.
Well, for several days now, the media in India has been dominated by the death of Bollywood superstar Rashid Khanna. There have been growing tributes for the man who was a great romantic hero, for his legions of fans making more than 150 movies over four decades. The actor who was 69 died in Mumbai after The actor who was 69 died in Mumbai after a prolonged illness. Such was the outpouring of emotion that there were some unlikely scenes, not at least jousting MPs in Goa trying to outsing each other while discussing a condolence motion. But after the tribute, stories started to emerge claiming that Kaka, as he was popularly known, had a dark side of which few outside his immediate circle were aware of. Richard Erwart speaks to Mitu Boamiklang, a film producer from India.
I was just having a chat with my mother, and I was really surprised because she is such a absolutely academic kind of a lady. And she said she was actually feeling very sad because everyone, when she was in college, used to worship him. And if you threw all the Bollywood greats, all the Khans and the Bachchans that we have today, they would still not match up with the kind of adulation and the frenzy that Rajesh Khanna had in his time. And I think just comparing it to Hollywood, just by the sheer number of eyeballs, I think Hollywood would fall short in some way.
That in itself is quite extraordinary. And I suppose that the other extraordinary thing about it is, what was it that made him so popular? Was it because he was the first, or was it really down to his personality?
I think maybe it was a combination of several things. I mean, he definitely was not one of the first romantic heroes that we had. Before him, there were a lot of like Shammi Kapoor and Shashi Kapoor and all these Dev Anand, all these big matinee idol stars that India had. But for some reason, when he just emerged in the late 60s, he kind of just took over because he did these really amazing romantic films, and he wasn't really drop-dead handsome, but he was wonderfully charming. Like, even now, when I look at his films, you don't feel that it's dated and it's very cheesy, because he's just so charming and so romantic, and just the small nuances in his acting that he did. So I think he had women swooning, and the kind of hysteria that his films generated was, it seems, unheard of, never seen before or after for any film star. Like, women were writing love letters with their own blood and things like that, you know. And I think nobody was unaffected by it. Even people like my mother, who I would never imagine remotely interested in any Bollywood star, and very, very academic, even she was enamored by him, which kind of speaks volumes, you know.
Now, you say that you feel his films didn't date, but having said that, did they perhaps go out of fashion at some stage? Did people going to Bollywood movies start seeking something else?
I think, you know, the Rajesh Khanna phenomena, like it is called in India, was slowly replaced by the angry young man, which was Mr. Amitabh Bachchan. I do feel that that also has a lot to do with the changing socio-economic scenario of the country. I mean, the 70s definitely saw a lot more disenchantment among the common people, and hence rose the common man, the angry young man, who was a crusader fighting for justice. And Rajesh Khanna represented the whole romantic era, was where love was everything and winning the woman you loved was the most important thing. And that gave way to Amitabh Bachchan's time, where social justice, fairness, equality for all was more important than anything else. I think somewhere those changing times resulted in the fall in his popularity rather than him as a person, you know?
In amongst all the adulation that he has received in the days since his death, other stories are starting to emerge now, looking at perhaps a side of Rajesh Khanna which most people were unaware of. The Times of India, for example, has run with a story with the headline, "The Darker Shades of Rajesh Khanna's Life," and they compare him in his latter years to Howard Hughes. They suggest he was a recluse who'd basically lost all his friends and connections with his relatives because of the way he behaved. He had a very big ego, I understand. Is that something you recognise?
It's one of those very, very sad, classic, tragic stories of all great actors and artists, and the tale of their fall where they become their own worst enemy. And he did become the big recluse. He had this beautiful bungalow where people, fans from all over the world, would come just to hope and stand in front and try and catch a glimpse of him. Somewhere, I feel that he didn't keep up with the times. Unlike his contemporaries, he didn't move on to do character roles or stronger roles or television or writing. He did dabble in politics, which did not work out. He had a very strange relationship with his wife, with whom he had separated. However, she did stand by him during his last days. He had two daughters who also dabbled in acting and then got happily married. He's a complete film family. His son-in-law is one of the biggest actors that we had. But even though he was so connected in every way, he managed to completely disconnect himself from the film industry, from the common people, and just chose to stay a very sad, in a way, life where he didn't mingle, he didn't meet people, he didn't meet his fans, his friends. And I think he died a lonely man, which is quite sad. But the fact that the whole industry and the whole country came out to celebrate his life and give him the kind of ceremonial farewell that they did is a testimony of how popular and loved he still is.
And with that, on the death of the Bollywood superstar Rashid Khanan, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to contact us to let us know what you think of the program, please do so. Our email address is very simple, pcj@pcjmedia.com. Once again, pcj@pcjmedia.com. You can also listen to this program again, as well as find all past editions at our website, www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. We're going to leave you today with a big hit from Rashid Khanan. So until next time, friends, this is Keith Perron, hoping that you join us again very soon. Until next time, bye-bye. Chingari koi bhadke सावन उसे बुझाए सावन जो अगन लगाए उसे कौन बुझाए हो उसे कौन बुझाए पतझर जो बाग उजाड़े वो बाग बहार खिलाए जो बाग बहार में उजड़े उसे कौन खिलाए ओ उसे कौन खिलाए पूछो कैसे मंदिर टूटा सपनों का हमसे मत पूछो कैसे मंदिर टूटा सपनों का